David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks, and welcome to the very first episode of Marvel Noise Classics. I'm your host, Steve Raker, coming at you from the comic book bunker. We here at the Marvel Noise podcast have had difficulties this past year keeping up with the bi-weekly schedule due to, well, mainly my vestibular pathology, but also Kevin's recent schedule where he's been working nights, which has been making scheduling recordings awfully challenging between that and the West Coast vantage point that Andrew takes. So, with the 10-year anniversary of the show last year, and my 10-year anniversary contributing to the show last month, I kind of thought it would be fun to pull up some of the old segments that new listeners to the show haven't heard that I've done in the past with guests and present them here as Marvel Noise Classics. New episodes of Marvel Noise will keep coming. These are just bonus episodes of classic material. First up, Andrew the LA Rabbit and I do a deep dive into the fantasy masterpieces that were the original Blue Cape era of Doctor Strange. From Marvel Noise episode 142, back on January 31st, 2011. Enjoy!
Hey, horror-y hosts of Hoggoth! Stephen Strange Raker here from the Comic Book Bunker, along with my leggy apprentice, our own L.A. Rabbit, Andrew Sanford. Yay, Andrew's back again.
Yay, thanks, Steve. Thanks for inviting me back to the bunker.
Anytime. This has been a lot of fun for everyone, I think, regarding the feedback we've gotten when you're on. So let's keep doing this as much as we can, you know, physically arrange it. Andrew and I decided on some more material to cover. We retire to our respective benches and are ready to come out swinging, metaphorically in this case, since we're long distance. And we settled on just a little over the first year of Doctor Strange stories, the first 16 installments in the pages of Strange Tales, which were issues 110 and 111 and 114 through 127, which is from mid-1963 to fall 1964 real time. Cover dates, you know, 3 months later at the time. These are quite literally strange tales told in the magical Marvel manner in this, the self-proclaimed greatest series devoted to the mystic arts in all of present-day literature. These first 16 stories represent the Blue Cape era of the character, and it's roughly the first half of the recently released trade paperback version of the Marvel Masterworks Doctor Strange Volume 1.
This was from the split book era of Marvel. As people may or may not be aware, there were some distribution issues, which we're not going to get into, but a lot of Marvel books, what they would do was they had a smaller publishing schedule, so they would split and have the front half of the book be given to one character and the back half to the other. We mentioned this when we were doing our Captain America run as well. So in this case, we're going to be sharing the front half with the Human Torch, and the back half is Doctor Strange, and the actual anthology is the Strange Tales, as Steve mentioned. I voted for this personally because of the cover appearance on 110 of my favorite Pastepot Pete going after the Human Torch. Of course, he doesn't cross over the Doctor Strange, but still, I got to give love for my favorite past villain of old times, Pastepot Pete.
I know that issue 110 has a great Kirby Human Torch cover with the torch trapped by the wizard and Pastepot Pete, and the wizard refers to Pete's invincible Pastepot gun, yet it's like leaking paste gunk out of the top, you know, and I'm like surprised he doesn't stick his own shoe to the ground with the way that thing's dripping. But I mean, how great do these torch covers look interdispersed within these Doctor Strange stories? Like, I loved these solo torch stories as a kiddo. I can't remember where I read them as reprints, but I mean, seeing these here make me really want a budget to buy these Marvel Masterworks of the Torch solo stories that they have, I think, two volumes of now, to, like, read to my kids, because it's, like, against the wizard and the trapster every issue and the eel, and, oh, man, it's really cool stuff.
It had a lot of fun to it. It was totally sort of the Marvel's take of the kooky era of villains. And, you know, I love the French painter's hat that Paige got. I mean, it's just fun, good fun comics. And it's nice, not to say that the comics we're going to review aren't fun, but there's a little bit of hint of the master of black magic. You do have to be a little concerned about we're plumbing the depths here, Steve. I hope you have the appropriate mystical protections around the bunker.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I think I'm protected by the aura of just having a calling to do this. Like, by the end of Strange Tales 122, from Stan's closing caption on the last panel, says, "Hark to these words, loyal reader. One day, many years hence, you will proudly relate these Doctor Strange tales to a new generation, a generation which will envy the fact that you were privileged enough to have read the earliest of these trend-setting tales." And I do. This will be fun.
Yes, yes. And as Steve mentioned, these are the Blue Cape adventures. For me, I was familiar with some of these stories, but for somehow my mind retconned him to have the Red Cape, even though I'm familiar with this first Nightmare appearance and everything. But for whatever reason, in my head, I always pictured this with him with the Red Cape. So it was fun to be corrected by the fact that he's actually didn't have the Red Cape at this point.
As a kid, I had a little pocket-sized paperback color reprint of the first bunch of these Strange Tales, Doctor Strange stories. So I have some nostalgia to them, reading them as a youth for sure. But issue 110 was sort of in the early summer of 63, and the villain was Nightmare, and they basically, you know, these were five-page backup stories originally, but they eventually, a few issues down the line, evolved into 8, 9, and 10 pages as a co-feature, although the Doc didn't even earn himself a half a cover until issue number 123. But, you know, the character and his surroundings are kind of established, and Strange is sent into a man's dreams, but not before visiting the Ancient One in his astral form, which is described in a number of different ways back then, which is really cool, first called his metaphysical spirit form. And the Ancient One tells him to rely on his enchanted amulet, which Strange does over and over, issue after issue, in fact.
There is a certain pattern to his over-reliance on the amulet, perhaps, but there is still some strategy involved. The other interesting thing about a character like Doctor Strange is he allows Stan Lee and Ditko to tell sort of your classic Twilight Zone kind of zinger stories.
That they were the best at. Yeah, they were the best team at doing those little quick O. Henry ending, you know, stories.
I don't even know that Doctor Strange was really even intended to be a long-term character. You almost get the feeling that sometimes it's more of a vehicle for the stories, where you always get the feeling that some of the other characters, there's a much more attempt at a broader story, like Spider-Man right from the beginning. I feel a little bit, not to say these aren't in continuity, but they feel much more like discrete adventures.
There was no way they could know that this guy was going to stick with these kinds of kooky, offbeat, occult stories like this, you know? I mean, they're playing up on some of the interest in mysticism and Tibetan culture and llamas and stuff like that that was in the culture at the time, but who knew if it was going to stick for the audience that they were geared towards, and the audience that ended up finding was a college bunch, which is kind of neat.
And what was particularly effective for me for an opening story is you're dropped into the middle of an existing character. When Nightmare encounters him, he's like, oh, it's my old enemy. So you feel like this is an established world that you're poking in on, where oftentimes first issues, it's like clearly you're being introduced to here's a new hero, here's his new powers. I really enjoyed the feeling like we're just opening up on Doctor Strange. He's already established. He's already in the world. And to me, it made it more complete story. I'm not that much into origin stories at times. I feel sometimes you're treading a lot of the same ground. So just to be thrown into the middle of an adventure with Nightmare is my favorite. I know there's a lot of great Doctor Strange villains, but I really like the other humanness of Nightmare, where Mordu, you know, he's just basically an evil Doctor Strange, so he's not as interesting for me.
Yeah, these were great stories. There's no question. Here, Doctor Strange encounters Nightmare and has that classic Lee Ditko twist ending where the guy Strange is trying to help is a crook, and he double-crosses Strange. But in the end, the amulet saves the day, and the criminal is driven to confess his crime so he can again sleep at night, which wraps things up nice and tidily. And I really like when things step right into the middle of the story, too. In fact, that's one of the things I loved about this recent Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes cartoon, where the first episode just hit the ground running, that here's the action, here's the villains. We don't have to take a whole episode to set up the origin of the villain before you get to battle the villain, and it's just action after action, and the audience is smart enough to catch up. We sure did.
And the other fun part is Nightmare is always shown in shadow, and he really works a lot. There's some nice scenes where the bad guy is nervous, sweating, and smoking the cigarette, and that is a classic Ditko character, the kind of, you know, nervous guy beaten down by life with just sucking on that cigarette like it's the last thing he's going to do, you know?
Yeah, paranoid and sweating and freaking out.
And there's just nice touches. He's lighting his cigarette, and his other hand has to steady his hand. You can tell it's kind of shaking. And just in one small little panel in the corner, I think that was just a nice, and he uses what looks like the light from the cigarette appears to be the light source for the picture. Just a lot of nice, that's like a really great panel in one little slice right there where you're establishing where the light comes from, the character's state of mind, everything. I just, Ditko, I think, might be a little bit underappreciated, so I want to let people know that they should really just check. He's not like any of the other people when you think of the founding of Marvel. They're all unique artistic talents, and I sometimes wonder, because Ditko kind of left, and he maintained such a quiet afterwards. I hope that people give him a shot if you're not familiar with it.
He's certainly respected enough by his peers, that's for sure. I also read in you know, thinking about this material, reread the Doctor Strange chapter of the Strange and Stranger World of Steve Ditko, Blake Bell book from Fantagraphics from a couple of years ago. And there's a great comment right up the alley of your thought here, Andrew, by John Romita Sr., who we know, you know, followed Ditko on Amazing Spider-Man. And he said, to quote, "I've been calling myself a paid illustrator for years. And the reason for that is guys like Steve Ditko. The difference is that when you're in their world, you don't have to look around and see which part of it reminds you of them. Everything reminds you of them. So when you talk about artists like Steve Ditko, you have to put them in a special category. They're what I call creators. The rest of us are illustrators. We illustrate as close as we can to what the editor and writer wants us to do. And that's not false modesty. That's the truth."
You're definitely going to, as you read these in batches, you're going to get a feel for how he constructs the story. And the other thing I really like is, I know the black and white reprints have been very popular of a lot of these old stories, but I think the use of color in these Doctor Strange stories is really great. When you get to the weird sort of landscapes and strange dimensions and everything, the color is as much of an artistic tool as, you know, the shading and the inking and all the other things, where in some of the other books, sometimes the color just feels like it's not needed, or, I mean, it's an interesting element, but here I feel the color, without the color, you really are missing something from some of these pieces here.
And they're so nicely recreated in these Marvel Masterwork collections, too. So nicely done. All right, issue number 111 of Strange Tales was versus Baron Mordo, where Mordo's introduced as an ex-disciple of the Ancient One, and he enchants a servant and poisons his former master. And then Strange and Mordo do battle in their astral forms, which here now are called spirit forms. And again, the amulet saves the day. Twice, in fact. First, it saves and revives the Ancient One, and then when Strange threatens Mordo that he'll use it to prevent Mordo from returning to his physical body, it also saves the day there. And actually, that's an idea that ends up biting Strange on the old karma wheel several issues down the road.
And they start to establish some of the rules. My apologies. I hope that motorcycle wasn't too loud.
Yeah, don't step out into traffic. Stay at the bus stop.
They start establishing the rules of astral combat and sort of the rules of how long you can be out, and it starts to really feel, despite the different terminology, I felt there was a real consistency. I mean, I don't mind a little bit of difference here and there. I just chalk it up to the mystical powers at work. But I feel that by having these different elements, it starts to introduce more unique storytelling elements and how the battles can be done, because now there's a level of strategy of when do you use the astral form. It has its limitations and its power, and it just writes another layer, because at the end of the day, when you're doing fight scenes, you can have one guy punching another or throwing a building on the other, but when you add another element, it just, to me, makes it a richer strategical concept of how am I have this new tool, how is each side going to use it? You can think more about the outcome of these conflicts.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's not coincidental that, you know, these consistencies are getting established now that they know that this is going to be a regular feature, because this is the point where they took a couple of months off, got a lot of feedback, and boom, in issue 114 now, Doctor Strange returns as a monthly co-feature from then on. And it's funny, in 9 of these first 16 Doctor Strange stories, he's pitted either against Mordo or Nightmare. In 9 of 16, Mordo 6 times and Nightmare 3 times. So they were really going to the well as far as establishing his arch enemies and nemesis.
And Doctor Strange might be one of the few characters in the Marvel Universe that's gotten younger as the years have gone on.
Right.
I really like in these old issues, he looks like an older, you know, his origin as being a surgeon, like he's an established medical professional, and then he goes into training. So it makes sense that he's older, and Ditko does a great, the white tips in the hair aren't just a stylistic effect and sort of the arched eyebrows. He just looks like this older sort of man, and now I think he's sort of been spun back to look quite a bit younger in the more recent artistic takes on his character.
Which is inevitable, unfortunately, after decades of publishing. In issue number 114, Mordo tricks Strange to travel overseas and then traps him within a candle's vapors, which paralyzes him until an untimely demise will occur when the candle burns out. Strange refuses the Ancient One's assistance when it's offered, but he doesn't mind reaching out telepathically and bewitching a local woman with some innate, untapped mystical potential to travel to him and free him. And this girl looks a little prettied up to me for a Ditko girl, didn't you think?
Yeah, she's definitely probably one of the most attractive people you're going to see, because the Mordo, Strange, and the Ancient One, none of those people are winning a beauty contest. But I wonder if at some point they were thinking of bringing her back as a recurring character. I don't know if some writer has plumbed the depths of that when he had his series in the 80s. Maybe we saw her return. I don't know.
Well, the reason why she looks a little prettier than the average Ditko girl is it turns out that George Russos, who's a golden and silver age penciler, inker, and colorist, in fact, he finished his career in the 60s and the 70s by being Marvel's cover colorist. But anyway, George Russos, who also went by George Bell in his Marvel Age era credits, was the uncredited inker on this issue, Strange Tales number 114, which is why everything has a little bit of a Kirby-looking finishing touch to it, because that's what Russos was used to doing. That was the house style of Marvel.
And he actually gets credited in some later issues that we're going to run over. That was a nice catch on this one, because there is something a little bit off about this one, and I don't mean off in necessarily a negative way, but I prefer Ditko when it's pure and unfiltered. I mean, I like
same here.
Mr. Bell's work, and he's known as a really highly regarded inker and well-established, but you can tell there's a strong sort of more of a Kirby vibe, as far as I'm concerned, in the
there
artwork.
Is.
And he's almost cleaning up Ditko is what it feels like to me, which is just in some ways kind of counter to what we want in our Ditko work.
At the end of the story, Strange battles Mordo and he sends him packing. And despite recognizing a dormant talent for sorcery in this woman, and despite her asking Strange if he could teach her and if she could be his disciple, she asks outright. He kind of blows her off with a maybe later kind of a attitude. But that kind of touches on, I think what you're saying before, was there an idea to develop this? And I think this is probably the seed for having way down the line of having Clea as a disciple came from, having some type of female apprentice or disciple.
And I think that Doctor Strange works well. I mean, obviously, he traditionally has Wong, who I don't think we're going to see in this. I don't think we get to him yet by the time we...
He's already been at the mansion, hasn't he? Or at the Greenwich Village residence. I think he...
He might be in that first. Is he answering the door?
I think he does. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's not credited as Wong yet to be.
And he's drawn like a very generic Asian man and colored as such as well, unfortunately. In issue 115, we get finally, with now the feature being 8 pages, 7 pages plus a splash page, we get the origin story. And I love the editor's note from Stan on the splash page that's speaking to the reader, explaining that they forgot to tell his origin and have been flooded with letters demanding one, so here it is, you know? And I just love when Stan brings you in on the quote-unquote behind-the-scenes thoughts of editorial and the Marvel wheelhouse.
And now, it does make sense that we need to know where, you know, we finally have reached a point where it would be good to know sort of who is this doctor. Like we've had enough of a tease, sort of. I think right. This is a good point to introduce, okay, who is this guy? Where did he come from?
And they're longer stories now, too, so it's time to really get all the clouds cleared for him and figure out who this character is. And we know the story, right? Strange is a petty, greedy, rich surgeon who lives for money, but he's got an accident and he injures his hands. He can't practice anymore. He bottoms out as a derelict, but he hears rumors of an ancient one in the far remote east, and this guy can heal anything. So Strange seeks him out and he becomes kind of a pet project for the old master. And the ancient one kind of sees the promise of potential with him, and a kind of a bad winter storm traps him there for a little while. During that time, he kind of discovers the ancient one's other pupil, who is the nearly fully taught Baron Mordo, plotting with Dormammu to slay the ancient one. And Strange decides to become the Ancient One's student and to one day be able to take on and defeat Mordo, and becomes Doctor Strange, the master of black magic. And that's what he's frequently referred to from his first appearance in 110 until about issue number 118, that he was the master of black magic.
And I would really, this is some of Ditko's finest facial work. You're looking at 9 panels per page here. And I really think he does a great job of, you see Doctor Strange age as the, well, before he's literally Doctor Strange because he's a surgeon. And then some nice shots of the old one. And my favorite is, again, the burned out Stephen Strange on the dock with a cigarette in his mouth,
yeah,
overhearing the 2 sailors coming off duty. And then the other element I like is Mordo puts a spell on Strange, which prevents him from talking and prevents him, in some cases, from moving in his hands. And they do with this lightning bolt and this gag that's not visible to other people. And I just think it's a really excellent visual use of the comic book medium that works. I guess you could have it in a TV where with cutaways it's there and it's not, but it'd probably be more confusing. And I just think this is one of the something you can do in comics that works particularly well, that maybe, I don't know, that would work so well in another medium.
You bet.
And I also feel that Doctor Strange's motivations are very clear and believable when you look at this arrogant surgeon. And he sort of takes it as an affront. First of all, he has the healing nature, but he also has a lot of pride. And I think being treated so dismissively by Mordo sort of stings him back into action. And to me, it makes it, some of the origins are a little bit shaky on their motivation. I mean, obviously, I feel Spider-Man is pretty strongly established. But sometimes it feels like, really, this would be the natural, logical outcome, where I felt that it was fully within the elements laid within the character, and it's consistent, and I think it's a strong story.
Yeah, I think it's cool that his circumstances made him from the ultimate ruling class, elitist, success story, American dream type, to basically a down-and-out outcast, and then his powers end up being sort of outcast-based, sort of mystical and occult and an outsider. And, you know, he was sort of driven to be an outsider, and yet that's where he sort of found his power base. You know, he's an outsider superhero. It's pretty cool.
And I would also imagine that the things to drive you to become a great surgeon, sort of the drive to study and work really hard, align themselves with the drive to read all these texts. Like the end of it is him practicing endlessly. And that's one of the things I enjoy. They always make an effort that he's one of these characters that's always working on improving himself. He doesn't really have a downtime. He's not taking pictures for the Bugle or doing anything else. He's working on becoming a better mystical practitioner. And I just like that idea of constantly improving and striving, and it seems to fit perfectly with common tropes of the mystical world that, you know, it's this thing that you got to constantly stay on the edge of, and you can't possibly learn every spell and everything.
Yeah, but quite literally, knowledge is power. It's a great mantra. In 116, the next issue, we get Nightmare again. And there's a great opening couple of caption boxes that kind of present Nightmare. And again, it's, you know, it's Stan talking right to the reader that I just love about these stories. And you know, Nightmare's realm, Ditko starting to really sort of explore the way he's going to be shaping these other dimensions. And Nightmare's, like, castle base in the dream dimension is really something out of, like, Tim Burton's Nightmare movie or something. I mean, really wild looking, really Halloween influenced looking. But Stan says, "If you are an ordinary human mortal, the scene your uncomprehending eyes are gazing upon is unfamiliar and a startling sight, for it is not of our dimension. It is a segment of the dream dimension, ruled over by the tyrant known as Nightmare. Nightmare the powerful, Nightmare the cruel, Nightmare the evil." I was thinking of, like, I was thinking of Mel Brooks in History of the World Part 1. Torquemada, do not ask him for mercy. Torquemada, do not ask him for forgiveness. Let's face it, we can't torque him out of anything. You know? But in this story, the police are seeking Dr. Strange's help to solve a mystery of people falling asleep but not waking up. And surprise, Nightmare's involved. And I see right here on this page that Wong is right there bringing the police and the police's medical expert into Doctor Strange.
Yes, but at this point, I think he's still just a servant. I don't think we get the fact of him sort of learning the ropes, as
it
were.
Oh, that's for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
But I do like, and here is where you get some of the, it's not only use of shadow, like I said, but there's some great color as well. All these things not only are misshapen, strange, dark creatures, but they also have these great purple and blues and oranges, and along with the sort of misshaped physiques of the creatures, it just, to me, it's a really delightful place that I don't know if this was in black and white that I'd be quite enjoying it in the same degree.
Yeah, if things were drawn intended to be black and white, I like to see them in black and white, but if they were intended to be in color, I like to see them reprinted in color. That's just me. But the other thing cool here is, again, the spine of Doctor Strange's universe is really being built here. Doctor Strange consults the Book of the Vishanti for the first time here and says it contains every counterspell known to the Mystic Arch, which is kind of cool. And he also invokes the Dread Dormammu for the first time, although we saw Mordu do so previously. And he also invokes the All-Seeing Agamotto and summons the Hosts of Hoggoth for the first times.
And we're also going to see Sidorak will be coming, the Bands of Sidorak, and some of the other classic, the Moons of Menapor.
And Doctor Strange enters the dream dimension with his astral form, now called his ethereal self. And actually, one other thing, Ditko used an astral form 5 years prior to Doctor Strange when he was doing work with Charlton in the late 50s, actually in 1958, in a book called Out of This World, number 7. And kind of depicted it the exact same way as kind of this white, you know, thinly outlined figure, spirit form that rose from the physical form, leaving that behind, which is cool. But like you said, he enters the dream dimension, and it's like sparsely decorated with these dendritic appendages and reptilian jaw gateways and these crusty stone pathways. And Strange says he has to remain on Hoggoth's path for protection, and if he steps off the path, then he's vulnerable to Nightmare's magic and stuff. And he ultimately outwits Nightmare's traps and rescues the mortals he's captured with, of course, his enchanted amulet saving the day, and ultimately that's what drives Nightmare back.
And again, they're using a lot of common tropes. It's as old as fairy tales, the idea that as you're safe as long as you stay on the path.
Sure.
And that the forces will always try and trick you off the path, and once you're tricked off, you're at their mercy, and can you find your way back on? And here it's done, I think, to good effect, but mainly it's due to these crazy, crazy escapes. And like I said, I don't know that you ever really see Nightmare's face in full on. There's always a great deal of shadow over it. And I just, for me, he was my favorite Doctor Strange baddie.
Cool. In issue number 117, we get Baron Mordo again, and Mordo captures Strange's entire home and traps Strange in this, like, bottle-like mystical prison, making him like a little genie in a bottle. But fortunately, Strange reports that it is written that the good must always triumph over evil, which is awfully reassuring, I thought. And he then learns that his prison has no floor, but the walls of the spell are continuous through the ground and into the earth as he follows the mystical tube down right through the center of the earth and out the other side, which conveniently puts him closer to the Ancient One's dwelling in time to kind of pull a Red Riding Hood wolf-style trick on Mordo by beating him there and replacing his master.
And I also like how Mordo was going to do a fake penitent act. So right. He get in with, you know, rolls his eyes up, oh, I'm so sorry, and then whammo, stick it to the Ancient One. But it's interesting, there's a lot of distraction and mistaken identity as a strategy as well, we're going to see, where someone takes the guise of someone else, someone creates a fake version of themselves to lure an attack. And I just think it makes it fun. Like I said, at the end of the day, we read a lot of comics, and it's a lot of one muscle-clad guy punching another. So this just has one little twist that you can put in the middle of a fight scene to throw yourself off. And it's something else.
And I love the last panels in these stories. They're pretty consistently usually like a faraway shot of the doc in repose or contemplating in his study or something, and they're coupled with some closing remarks and a pitch for the next issue or something. And this issue really made me think of, yeah, these last panels are fantastic, as the doc's sitting underneath his window that's so obviously inspired by Eisner's spirit and you know, Will Eisner's work. And, you know, the rooms are so nicely decorated with these, you know, ornately shaped baubles and urns and incense burning devices and stuff. It really, Ditko's affection for, like, curio shops and arcane objects and some Tibetan influences really come through on the page in such a enjoyable way.
And he also gives a good sense of that these rooms inhabit a space in a way that feels consistent. I know I'm not doing a good job describing it, but it feels like a real place in a way, and not just from the perspective, but just there's almost a consistency to it, even though I'm not comparing panel to panel, but it feels like a real room that he's sitting in. And sometimes with some of these otherworldly things, you don't always have that, but his house, not only the style, but just how it's laid out really feels like a real place, the Sanctum Sanctorum.
Yeah. And then issue 118 of Strange Tales, which is at the very beginning of 1964, we get our first other villain besides Mordo or Nightmare. We get these interdimensional possessors. The tale opens, Strange unveils his earthly scanner, which is this globe that arises from this ornate gold housing, and reveals a little black smudge over the geographical area that magic is being used to menace mankind, as Strange says. This leads Strange to a town in the Bavarian Alps where people are being bewitched and they're not really acting themselves.
And the device he uses looks an awful lot like a device we're going to see coming up, the Eye of Amagato.
Right.
Saying these things is really a tongue twister for me, but it's very similar to that. And we have Dr. Strange showing up at our Bavarian village. And again, the language where we're learning our frau and hair and all that.
Yeah, I mean, the remaining normal townsfolk comment on this mysterious figure. They, you know, he seems to have arrived from nowhere. His manner, his clothes, and most of all, his eyes. How awesome he looks. And that reminds me that Dr. Strange's eyes from the beginning had a really mysterious Asian look to them, often appearing angled and squinted and certainly not typical English North American eyes. And they'd actually remain Asian looking from the, you know, his first tale in 110 up until issue number 121 of Strange Tales, which is the 10th Dr. Strange story.
And also, I think it helps, like I said, that they make him look a little bit older, adds a little bit to the sort of deep, mysterious eyes to a touch. You know, like they've seen a lot of action. And in this, it's helped by the fact that they give it this sort of yellow sight that he has that lets him penetrate these possessed people.
Yeah, he finds the enchanted townspeople. He analyzes one guy and drives the possessing spirit away. And it turns out he's part of a race of invading interdimensional aliens who can assume a spirit form and possess mortal men. And this town's like the dry run for a full-scale invasion that's thwarted here by Strange, thanks again multiple times to his enchanted amulet.
And the design of these aliens, you have a telepathic alien. And so they're humanoid, but they have no mouth, which makes great sense and gives them a believable yet really creepy appearance. You know, when you see like a green creature and there's no mouth, it's just it's a brilliant design, I think.
In this issue, too, the doc calls upon the mighty Mormammu. Which I was thinking, could this be like the alliterative cousin of the Faultine face Dormammu? And I also thought it was funny when Strange reveals that he possesses no greater power than the basic power of imagination, the gossamer thread of which dreams are woven. God, gotta love that stuff.
And the other favorite part is he takes this thinker-esque pose where hand on the chin, the other hand on his hip,
yeah,
while he contemplates the problem. That to me is just a strange position, but it seems to fit. You know, he's the master of the black magic arts. You know, he's going to, of course, assume deep contemplative thoughts.
When he has to battle the leader of these interdimensional aliens, kind of something interesting. If you follow Doctor Strange's current adventures that involve the New Avengers as handled by writer Brian Bendis the last several years, you might find it interesting to know that in this issue, Strange Tales 118, the master of black magic himself, Doctor Strange, calls on, quote, all the mystic forces of the shadow worlds and the hosts of darkness. So he's been calling on the dark forces and the dark side since the beginning, not just at the end of World War Hulk or whatever, after which now they have him stripped of his title and his mastery of the mystic arts. Right from the beginning, he was the master of black magic, and he was calling on all the shadow world. So all this stuff was pretty clearly well established from the beginning. And it's one of those things that kind of leave a funny taste in my mouth when looking at Strange's current state of affairs.
I also like that there's less of a hierarchical sort of design to everything. Like there's one Sorcerer Supreme and all that. I just like sort of a more chaotic approach if he's just this masterful magician, and he made this vow early on never to take anyone's life and always save people and do what he can. And if that involves invoking whatever powers, I mean, I get from his perspective, I think all these powers are kind of dark and mysterious, and it's the ends to which you use them and not the powers themselves that he judges them by, because he makes it very clear that he's sworn to help all people out, and that provides a useful vehicle to get him in all these kind of wacky adventures with people you're never going to see again, because if someone appeals to him for aid, he's forced to go aid them. And it's just a fun design and conceit that I like more than this idea of that he has some, he's only doing like these super uber level threats. Like in these stories, it's like whatever problem comes his way, he's going to jump in, roll up his sleeves, and fight it.
But he's using black magic, Andrew. Black magic! But actually, speaking of which, the closing of this issue is the first time that he's called the mystifying manipulator of the supernatural, Doctor Strange, the master of the mystic arts, instead of the master of black magic. And two issues later, in Strange Tales 120, he'd be called the master of mystic arts right on the masthead and twice more within. So they were really trying to establish it from then and thereafter. And by issue number 122, it'd be right on the cover blurb. So this is where that transition is. They sort of backed off of the master of black magic. Funny.
Well, I think that I also did a little bit of research, but my research involved watching the 1978 Doctor Strange TV pilot.
Oh, God.
Starring Peter Hooton and Jessica Walter, who you
Talk
might
about
know.
Taking one for the team, Andrew. Jeez.
Who you might know from Arrested Development, but it's hard to believe that never got picked up for a TV show. But yeah, anyways, it doesn't really relate to this material, but I wanted it noted for the record that I did.
No, you don't take a hit like that and not at least get credit for it. I remember watching it as a kid at the time and being like, ooh, okay. The next issue, number 119, was Beyond the Purple Veil. And the splash page of this really tickles my fancy in so many ways. It's this really amazing shot of Strange passing his arm through to the purple dimension. And what's in the purple dimension, it doesn't even matter. Doctor Strange's figure itself, his cloak is so well drawn. It's such lovingly shaped brush strokes that depict his cape and his loose shirt, that it could easily have been drawn in this modern era by someone with like kind of clean pop art style, like a Cliff Chang, who we know from the Acrosstown Rivals over with Green Hour Black Canary a couple of years ago. And he just did that Neil Young Greendale hardcover too. But Cliff Chang's stuff, you could make a rubber stamp of this image of Strange. And thinking about what it would look like without color, where everything that's blue is truly a negative, it really blows my mind. It's one of the nicest, cleanest figures of the Doc that Ditko drew, in my opinion. It really touched me in ways I can barely explain.
Well, it's really nice because the legs and the gloves are completely pure silhouette in a way. Well, the gloves have a little bit of sheen, but the legs are just perfect silhouette, which really, to me, makes all the sort of flowing of the cloak and the shirt and the sash kind of pop so much more. So I agree with you. It is quite a striking, but I just love the choice of a perfect black silhouette. No shading, no lines, no anything. Just this outline of the legs coming out of that oversized shirt or cloak or whatever you want to call that, his top part to it. Yeah, I agree with you. And of course, the amulet is blasting full on.
And it's kind of funny because, in posting a cover gallery for this material, there's not going to be a lot of covers that make you think anything about the Doctor Strange stories, because they're all going to be Human Torch covers practically. But I'll take the time to scan this splash page and get it up on this episode's thread on the forum, because it's worth it, especially after I took so much time trying to describe it. Also, in this issue, Doctor Strange invokes both Mormammu and then Dormammu on facing pages, so this wasn't just a coincidence. But some burglars stumble upon a sinister purple gemstone after Strange catches them sneaking around his house, levitates them, and sends them out the door, and then they sneak back in and they find this gemstone, and they're teleported beyond the purple veil, which they're then enslaved by Agamemnon, the local dictator. And turns out, in the long run, Doc's enchanted amulet is once more too much for the opposition, and in the end, the crooks end up being scared straight. And when you mentioned the Eye of Agamotto before, this amulet is his old original square amulet with this little round circle eye in the middle that's never referred to as any sort of eye or all-seeing eye or anything to do with Agamotto, even though it does have an eye function where the eye will separate from the little housing and land on the Doc's forehead. But this old amulet gets pretty much forgotten and put by the wayside when we wrap up this arc.
And these opening couple of pages, I really love when the robbers come in, because it's all done in shadow. And again, it's Ditko in that sort of seamy underworld crime feel. And it's right out of the opening of these few pages could be right out of any crime comic of the era. And then you quickly segue into this bizarre dimension of Agamemnon and his ray blast versus Doctor Strange. And of course, being that Doctor Strange is willing to sacrifice himself where the other guy wasn't, so he gives up and lets Doctor Strange go. And I do like the smirk on the second to last panel of Doctor Strange when he hears about the guys going straight. And it ends with another classic shot of the interior, and you have the smoking incense coming out and sort of the strange skylight pattern, and he's staring at the crystal, trying to penetrate its deep thoughts and everything. And again, it just gives you that feeling of a place and a time that you talked about before.
The other thing I like about that smirk panel is his one eye is in shadow, but he actually gives a wink, but it's not him that's winking. It's his amulet has like a little gleam on the side. So it's like Strange is smirking and like the amulet's giving the little effect of a wink. It's pretty well crafted. The next issue is issue number 120, which puts Doctor Strange against the House of Shadows, which is pretty much just a haunted house where Strange kind of observes this on-location television stunt where a correspondent reports live from within an actual haunted house, but then the signal goes dead and the guy disappears. But Doc makes the rescue and sends the house, which itself ends up being an interdimensional sentient being, back where it came from. And really, this was like another big public display of sorcery as the gathered crowd watches. And kind of, in fact, the Doc's been pretty high profile and public up until this point. He displayed his magic to those crooks the first time they came into the house. The police know him and know to come to him. He's been in the papers and is highly regarded in all this business. So he's pretty high profile.
And in this one, you do see the amulet open up and the third eye, as they say, I believe, in mystical circles, goes to Doctor Strange's forehead, so you get some interesting visuals out of that. It's a stylistic thing, but there are quite a few. This is a busy kind of comic where it's jam-packed. You have these long word balloons, usually a lot of caption boxes. I mean, I think it works, but I do want to warn people that you're getting into it. These aren't a lot of just static images, and I certainly hope that the letterer negotiated a per word basis for his compensation on these. Because if you're thinking at the same time, you know, he could just cut across and pick up the Hulk book and, you know, letter a few Hulk smash out in the desert type of thing. Where in this, he's going to have to write a full page worth. It makes a... It, like I said, I hope he's getting compensated appropriately for it. Before all you Hulk fans get down on me, yes, I realize this is 63, 64, and this is pre-Hulk smash era. This is when the Hulk was just sort of like a sort of slow-witted bad guy who had more of a mind than he's traditionally portrayed to be. I do appreciate that, and was doing that more for comedic effect, of course. And as a little side note, I'm sure you all might know or might not that Ditko actually drew some of those early Hulk stories. So if you want to see an interesting, less sort of bulked up version of the Hulk, you can check out like Incredible Hulk number 6. Hulk also was in a split book, Tales to Astonish. It started with number 60. And again, Ditko's drawing some of those too, if you want to check out sort of a different looking Hulk done a la Steve Ditko. Anyways, back to Doctor Strange. Sorry.
No, you spared yourself a whipping with a pair of purple pants. The next issue is Strange Tales 121, which now we tried a few different types of stories, and we're back to the Mordo and Nightmare rotation. This time, Doctor Strange has to deal with the fact that Mordo has stolen his body while he's in his ethereal form, and he's got to return to his host within 24 hours or certainly perish. And really the most striking thing when reading these issues in bulk was as of this issue in 121, Strange's eyes are now no longer Asian influenced at all, but they are, you know, typical North American looking eyes.
And I like that it lays out, again, you're getting more of the rules and we're finally seeing more of the drawbacks of the astral form, because I'm sure they started realizing they can't make it so powerful, because then why would anyone ever spend time in the real body? And again, we have another possession where Doctor Strange takes over a waxworks, and there's going to be an awful lot of possessing different objects and not possessing. And again, it just makes it back to the strategy element, because you get the feeling that Strange is just a better magician than Mordo. And the only thing that gives Mordo an edge is his sort of ruthlessness and his willingness to try and kill, where Doctor Strange makes, again, a clear point that he isn't going to, you know, kill anybody, and he's just going to punish Mordo by bringing him right up to the edge and then, you know, letting him get out alive.
In issue number 122 of Strange Tales, we get Nightmare again. Doctor Strange kind of carelessly falls asleep without saying his nighttime protective spells, and Nightmare takes him. But he ends up getting tricked by Strange's fake representation of the dream-eating Golgol. And I did my own research. I looked up a Golgol to see, is there such a thing? And there is. In the Philippine Islands, there's like a post-mortem tradition where participants rinse their hair in chicken blood and vinegar. And that is supposed to drive the dead person's spirit to heaven. It would certainly drive me as far as possible from that location.
But I do like the concept of, it demonstrates once again sort of the perilous world that this black magic is, which we've been warned about. Like just the simple thing that we've all done where you're working late one night and you just sort of pass out or fall asleep, but no sort of lapse is allowed for the master of the mystic arts, because any little mistake creates a massive power imbalance. And unlike Mordo, I always got the feeling that Nightmare was actually sort of way more powerful than Doctor Strange, and Doctor Strange had to sort of always trick his way or find some way around. He could never just brute force, unlike he sometimes does with Mordo. He has to find another way around to defeat him.
Absolutely. And in this issue and afterwards, the Doc's astral form is now referred to as his ectoplasmic self. So they keep trying to find something that they can settle on and that'll stick. And this issue, which also he is uncredited here, George Russos begins a 4-issue stint inking Ditko again. He does get credited on the next 3 issues as George Bell. But again, he gives this purposefully Kirby-influenced shine embellishment to Ditko's work. Not always, and sometimes not often, for the better. The girls looked prettier, that much is sort of benignly true, but there's definitely a difference, and I prefer Ditko's inks over his own work.
I prefer, too. One thing you'll notice is he really doesn't use shadow at all. For instance, this is the only time where you're going to see Nightmare's face almost all the time, or in the past issues, they make a point of always having it mostly in shadow, if not in completely. And it just is a real stark difference from seeing these dark shadows everywhere to seeing sort of everybody, you fully get their face, you fully get their thing. And to me, it sort of takes me out, but like I said, I can see where it goes more with like a Kirby style. But Ditko, we live in the shadowy world. He's the master of black magic. You know, we need to have these ambiguities and everything that help inform the picture.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Ditko drew the faces shadowy, because it looks like Rosos was really pulling from, gosh, I don't know where, in rendering those nightmare faces. But it looks like the details weren't there, and he was making it up as he went along, because they look pretty asymmetrical and unproportional and awfully ugly. I know we're talking about Nightmare here, sure, but in the next issue, number 123, Doc goes up against Loki. And what's kind of cool is that on the cover, Kirby draws Ditko's Doctor Strange on this, which is the magazine's first fully evenly split cover. And then on the inside pages, you get Ditko drawing Kirby's Thor and Loki. And, you know, I suppose Russus' Kirby-ing up the art here in the Asgard sequences may have been helpful in places, but I kind of like seeing Ditko's take on all things Asgardian. And I thought it was funny Stan felt the need to provide a splash page disclaimer of sorts that the art is drawn in the somewhat different Ditko style. In fact, it's so blamed different, we're trying to hide it from Jolly Jack Kirby.
And like I said, if you really want to see a fun on some of those early Hulk issues where they're flipping back and forth, it really is night and day when you see Kirby, who excels at those muscle-bound sort of heroic figures like a Hulk could be, versus Kirby's take on sort of a muscular but more of a strange-looking Hulk to it. So I agree with you. I would have loved to see a full-on Kirby Loki. I think that's a character that would have lend itself to sort of the strange otherworldly aspects.
Loki tricks Doctor Strange into using a magic hand to pull Mjolnir, Thor's hammer, away from Thor while Thor was flying, which sends Thor plummeting to his possible doom. So then Strange kind of realizes what's up, and he and Loki face off against each other. And in a pretty cool scene, Ditko depicts the famous Kirby horns on Loki's helmet, emitting an energy blast between them towards each other, that then kind of combines and radiates out in a more focused blast, which I thought was a really neat idea that kind of touches upon how kind of lightning works when you see it at the museum in one of those machines or something.
And I also like the idea, and this is something you see a lot, especially in these old Marvel, of Doctor Strange fully admits that he is way outclassed here, even though Loki is basically, we find out from the beginning, sort of has his hand tied behind his back because of the strictures placed on him, even in a lesser powered form. Doctor Strange really can't swing with a god. And I just like the fact, again, it forces him to use all these creative, and not for the last time we're going to see him create a bunch of fake doubles where none of them are really him. That's a staple he goes to. And you also get a throwback to the purple dimension that we saw before with one of those footnotes, which I miss so dearly. I really would love to bring back the footnotes in modern comics. They kind of, I was reading that Spider-Girl one, and I was like, man, they could drop a few footnotes in here. Tell us, I'm not that familiar with the Ariana character, not to get too sidetracked, but and it would have just been nice to be like, okay, go here, go here, go here, and get yourself up to date on the character.
And that's one of the many reasons you're always welcome here in the bunker, Andrew. I agree with you. Also, in a fun kind of early continuity moment, the Doc uses the power of the purple gemstone from four issues earlier to try to send Loki beyond the purple veil, which I thought was pretty cool. And that, of course, got its own little footnote reference.
And I also like, this is another one of those classic old, where they're winking about a guest appearance that never happens. And I do love those where it's like, oh, you're going to see Thor, and then he never really makes it to the team up. And that's just a classic old, you know, like, hey, and where they appear for half a panel or whatever.
At the end, the Doc is finally able to send Mjolnir back to Thor, not really defeating Loki in any way, but it's just in time to prevent him from splatting against the pavement. Thor's been falling all this time. And then the Doc just hangs in there, getting whittled away at until Loki hightails it back to Asgard because Thor starts poking his nose around, but never really arrives, as you say.
And then we have our end panel, as always, which is Doctor Strange in here. He sees Thor zooming off and makes a little reference. For every menacing enemy of mankind, there is a fighting Avenger. Interesting choice of words to describe
Thor. And then Stan goes right into plugging the Avengers book in the closing caption, and Loki as well, which is funny, and then tries to bring you back again. I love that. Doctor Strange will be back in next month's Strange Tales, just as sure as every little Hoggoth grows up to be a Deathless Vashanti. And the next one, Strange Tales 124, I had meant to look this up, but didn't. Actually, I see the credit right here. But the cover of this, how about this version of Paste Pot Pete?
Oh, I love the super skinny legs.
Yeah.
He looks like a real interest, and he lost the painter's hat, and he's got his big purple battle suit.
He's got the thing pasted up against the wall, and the Human Torch is flying in trying to put a stop to it, and then there's a few drums behind him that are labeled glue and paste, so it looks like he's got plenty of ammo around him, and he's in his element. And I see a little tiny signature. It's a Dick Ayers cover. Nice.
And I'm not sure the difference in his weapons when he's using his glue versus his paste, but glad to know there's a clearly delineated difference between the glue weapon and the paste weapon.
The proportion of horse that's contained within or something.
And I'm not sure how he's a new menace of Paste Pot Pete, but...
Well, now he's got armor.
Seems to be the same old menace, but anyways, I love me some Paste Pot Pete.
He lost the French hat, and he's got the helmet. All right, this issue 124, Doctor Strange encounters an enchanted mystery woman who's out of time, so he travels back in time to battle the evil Zota. And the earlier hosts of Hoggoth became the hosts of Hoary Hoggoth, and then in this issue, number 124, finally becomes the Hoary Hosts of Hoggoth. The Doc has to return back to present time before a spell-casting candle burns out. But he doesn't quite make it, so he has to call on a number of power sources to survive, including the Shades of the Seraphim, the Seven Rings of Ragador, and these are for the first times, and that enables his return. And then 2 pages later, he calls upon the Crimson Bands of Sidorak. So they're used to lift the Mystery Woman's spell. Stan was on a roll that month calling out the spells.
And this one also is inked by the same, and it really has, I'd say, the most different feel. It's really, he has these kind of thick lines, and it's very bright. And it's interesting, but it just feels the most different visually out of all the stories we've covered and the ones we're going to cover from and I don't mind it, but I mean, I prefer the other one. It's different as a change of pace, but it's, I would not use this one as a representative sample of what you would expect this book to look like.
And again, the mystery woman's face is so clearly not a Ditko face. Again, think of like Liz Allen from over in the Spider-Man books or something, you know?
I was going to say, Steve, you don't want to spoil this. You'll get a lot of angry people about who the mystery woman is. Should we leave that to
the... It's Cleopatra!
Oh, no. Direct all your angry comments to Steve about that one.
In Strange Tales number 125, it's Baron Mordo's turn again. And this issue finds Doctor Strange studying the spells of Oshtur, who's mentioned here for the very first time, and again he invokes the dread Dormammu. He called upon Dormammu's power quite a lot during these first months of Doctor Strange stories.
And he also checks out the all-seeing eye of Agamotto.
Yeah, but it's the Earth scanner device that he was talking about before. It's the ornate gold thing, and the Earth comes out, and there's a little black smudge, and he calls it the Eye of Agamotto here. And again, even though the amulet had an eye function, it was never named, and certainly we know that his amulet that he gets down the line is the Eye of Agamotto, so I think they just had a good name and they were looking for something to attach it to in this case. And for the inking thing, this is the one that bugs me the most, is this issue, because this is Mordo's, what I call his shower cap gaffe. George Russell's had trouble with Ditko's hairstyle for Baron Mordo, even way back in that uncredited issue number 114, way back in the early stories. And although Mordo's hairdo always kind of worked when Ditko provided the inks. For some reason, with Russo's, it kind of came out looking like a skull cap or a piece of armor or a shower cap or something. And he'd ink it smooth and featureless. And the colorist, who could have been Russo's himself for all I know, because the Masterworks leave those credits out because it's all recolored. The colorist even colored it here different than the rest of Mordo's hair, like a different shade. But fortunately, when Mordo next appears several issues later under Ditko's own inks, it looks back to, well, as normal as Mordo's hair ever gets, but it looks like hair again.
The other thing that would have been nice is they have this funny kind of round the world in 80 days when they're in astral form, where there's like the Eiffel Tower in one and the pyramids in the other. And
it's an epic globe-spanning battle.
And I would have liked to seen those worlds rendered a la Ditko.
Yeah.
That's the part I would have thought would have been fun to see, like his version of the Eiffel Tower and the Sphinx and all these things. But it's a fun, when they're sending out their fight, I like the one where it appears that Mordo has like six different arms and they're all these black power tendrils.
Very cool. And
there's just the mystical battle part's fun. But again, we know that the amulet's always going to save the day, and Mordo's kind of a third-rate villain.
He does. He just bathes him in the Spidey signal. I mean, in his enchanted amulet there, and he's just cowering in the corner at the end. Also cool, for the first time, the Doc swears by the 12 moons of Munipur in this issue, so I thought that was kind of cool. Now, issue number 126 and 7 are the last two issues we're going to cover here, and they're the last two issues of this Blue Cape era of Doctor Strange. And this is a two-parter that brings us into the domain of the Dread Dormammu. And the first issue, number 126, I mean, just from the splash page, wow! Like, Ditko is totally naturally secreting illegal brain chemistry by this time to depict this dark dimension. It's just fantastic.
And for me, this is the quintessential Doctor Strange story. But for some reason, my brain is poorly wired, and I always imagine Doctor Strange with a red cape. So for some reason, I'm very familiar with this story because it's the introduction of Clea and everything. But mentally, I have him doing this with a red cape, which is clearly wrong. I mean, this is not the last we see of the Dread Dimension. But this, if you think of the Doctor Strange story, for me, this is the one where he goes and he faces off in the Dread Dimension. And these excellent Kirby creatures populate this dimension. There's a guardian of the gateway which has no feet but all arms. Then he said, and then I think a chance for him to show again the use of different colors and shapes and design. And there's never any background. There's just these floating tendrils and images and creatures that populate it.
Totally, like floating roots and everything else. And you said his dimension was filled with Kirby creatures. You mean Ditko creatures?
My bad, yes.
But what's nice, too, about the Ditko here is that Ditko's back to inking himself, so we get the full Ditko shock value. And this is kind of a funny opening here, because just as the Doc returns to his physical form from around the globe when he was with the Ancient One battling Mordo and everything, he's saying, like, it's good to be back home. And then, like, the next instant, he's teleported away right back to the Ancient One's side for the next adventure. It's like, oh, what a wasted trip. And like you said, the guardian to the Dark Dimension is that big red cyclops multi-armed colossus thing. I just love this design of this guy with the horns sticking out. And what I really love is Paul Smith's version decades later in material that's actually now being printed with either next month's or the month after's hardcover collection. I think they have it titled Doctor Strange Into the Dark Dimension or something along those lines. But it's the Roger Stern, Paul Smith, and I think there was a fill-in issue or two by Brett Blevins from the around issue number 70s of the Doctor Strange series that went from the late 70s into the early 80s. And Paul Smith draws a fantastic version of this guy.
I think that was when he had the apostle the apprentice, Rintraw, that weird Minotaur-looking guy and everything.
That comes after.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, obviously I need a refresher, but I do love those stories. It's a fun era of Doctor Strange.
That was when they did the relaunch several months later, maybe even years, with Roy Thomas writing and Butch Geist did a lot of the art for that series. That was the Sorcerer Supreme stories where he had that supporting cast. This, like you said, Clea's first appearance is here, but she's not named in this two-issue arc. She's just the girl. But she's the girl with the wild fishnets and those super high heels. Even wilder hair curls. Even Princess Leia isn't even in this chick's class.
No. And I like, she also has a pretty hard look about her, too. I mean, there's a certain alluring beauty, but she definitely doesn't looks like the type of woman that I would come out the worst for wear.
She's a Ditko girl. She's drawn and inked by Ditko, so you don't get that same prettied up version, you know? Although, I loves me some Clea.
And I like the Dormammu, the ambiguous sort of cloudy head design, I think is just perfect. who else is going to build you a bad guy with no clear definable head?
And here he's blue-flamed Dormammu, which is kind of interesting. The plot basically this issue is getting to Dormammu. He's moving through the dark dimension, exploring and fighting a bunch of the denizens, you know, Dormammu's agents, before he finally, Dormammu's revealed at the end, and he meets Clea along the way. And I thought it was funny, too, that the dark dimension turns out to be pretty bright, you know? It's like this white, light blue, light green, yellow, and red featureless backgrounds that keep things pretty bright and the mystical elements kind of pretty separated by just even swashes of color.
They do play a lot with the dimensionality. For instance, when he passes through like this red carpet thing and his body goes in another one, he walks through these different dimensional walls. And I like the fact that perspective and motion and everything is really cut up in a visual way where things jump in from one part and jump out at another, and it's not done in sort of a real world way. And it just is a fun, it adds another otherworldliness to the aspect of it.
No question about it. You don't know which way is up. In issue numbered 127, which is the last issue we're going to cover here tonight in this epic retelling of Doc's first adventures. It's kind of cool. That made me think a little bit of Uncanny X-Men number 137, whatever it is, when Jean Grey finally dies and they have the big battle with all of the Shi'ar Imperial Guard. But they have that time before the battle where they all know they're going to battle, but they like retire to their quarters and have to think about it for a while beforehand. And that's just what Dormammu does for the Doc. He's no longer derives pleasure, he says, from defeating weak opponents. That sport bores him. So he sends the Doc back to some chambers to kind of think about it for a while before he has to come out fighting. The Doc came on pretty strong. The Doc came out kind of aggressive and picking a fight right from the beginning, which might not have been the best approach. But, you know, the Doc's kind of in his chamber kind of thinking about things. And one thing I love that isn't even not a lot of attention is brought to, but he's got his cape off and his cape is shown kind of hanging against the wall. But in four panels later at the bottom of the page, you get a side view of that cape standing there. And it's not attached to the wall at all. It's just standing up stiff, which I thought was a pretty cool little touch.
And I love this. This is the splash page I like a lot because it's got who is the mystery girl in the diabolical dimension? And poor Clea's imprisoned with these strange metal balls or whatever covering her hands and her head bowed down. And Doctor Strange is there and Dormammu. And it's just a great dynamic image that I enjoy.
Really,
and also the mindless ones I love that were introduced to them here. They're a great design sort of creature and concept, and the sort of cyclops blast they give out of their eye slots.
Oh, I love how the few panels where they're first introduced, they're shooting the cyclops blasts at each other. One's blasting one in the abdomen, the other one's blasting him in the thigh. The one's got another one lifted over his head, and he's going to throw him, and he's got that total kooky Ditko weightless pose, the guy who's in the air, and there's other ones that are kind of rising up out of this little like dimensional sewer that's steaming. It's an awesome introduction to these mindless ones. Really cool. And the panel on the previous page where they dive into the gateway that leads to where the mindless ones are is one of my favorite little panels that just show the back kind of legs of Clea and Strange, and they both look like they're diving into a pool, but they're going through this dripping, thick, almost like the inside of a piece of cheese kind of dimensional portal. Really neat looking. I just love these couple of issues, and that's really where Ditko goes after this point too. So we really got to do a part two of this sometime where we talk about the stories that come after this, because it's just issue after issue of this kinds of stuff.
Well, it starts getting into more ambiguously motivated villains. I was never that much, as I've described for Mordu, but here the problem is he can't just destroy Dormammu, because Dormammu is actually the defender of his dimension against the Mindless Ones. So you get sort of the more realistic perspective of conflicting motivations. So it's not just that, I mean, Dormammu's a conqueror and he's a bad guy, but Doctor Strange can't eliminate him, because then he's dooming the entire dimension to be destroyed by the Mindless One. So you'll start getting in new characters whose motivations aren't so clear, black and white.
Yeah,
and that makes a more interesting story.
There are things that are bigger than just the good guy, bad guy relationship that we're used to from the other superhero books, for sure. There's the intense mystical battle here between Strange and Dormammu, where, I mean, Ditko just has... You know, there's only so many ways to depict an energy blast, right? I mean, and spells at work. But Ditko finds all these great, unique ways. Some of them are where it's making, like, solid light constructs like you'd see coming from the Green Lantern or something. But, you know, he's got all these bending, twisting shields, and sometimes it's lightning, and sometimes it's melting, and, oh, man, it's just really, he just comes up with way after way of depicting energy being emitted, consumed, and transformed. And that in itself is real magic.
And the melting, I think, is particularly effective because it comes in a sequence after these sort of strong images of the magic, and then Dormammu just almost dismissively sort of melts the spells away. And again, you have the dimensionality where he sort of pokes his head in one and out the other.
Yeah.
And spells go through things and around things.
And I like, too, after he melts the Strange's prison, then he starts melting Strange. Like, not like I melt your walls, but now I'm melting you, too, buddy, you know? I'm melting!
And on the next page, we get Strange is in trouble. You can tell he's starting to sweat pretty hard. And there's a nice little touch of, like, you know, I'd probably be sweating pretty bad, too, because it's near the end.
And thanks to all those crime, twist, sci-fi, paranoia stories that Ditko and Lee did together prior to the dawn of the Marvel Universe, you know, nobody draws somebody who's paranoid or stressed or really fatigued like Ditko does.
And Clea is watching over this, and she sort of provides the play for play and helps put it in perspective, which I think is probably not needed, but I think back then they couldn't risk just having the two of them go at it without more commentary. So that's the one thing I would love to see now, is like a redo of Lee and Ditko of this story, because I think it would be a lot less.
No.
Oh, I like the verbosity and the alliteration, but I just think at times I wouldn't have minded just a few panels with no caption, no anything, just the images. Just, I don't need a lot. I would just like one or two where it's just the characters there.
I mean,
and sort of the images.
What this was the two cowboys fighting on top of a stagecoach while the girl is tied to the railroad tracks and the train is coming. Because you've got Clea there, and she's the one who's screaming out to them, "Hey, here come the Mindless Ones!" Because unfortunately, Dormammu is, although he's easily handling Strange, he is using up a lot of his energy. And like you said, he's the protector of his dimension against the Mindless Ones. He's erected the dimensional barrier that keeps the Mindless Ones at bay, else they would overrun his dimension. And now that that barrier is being weakened because Dormammu's using those forces against Strange, and here come the Mindless Ones. They've broken through, and they're coming right at Clea, literally like a runaway freight train. So Dormammu says, "Enough of you, mortal. I'll deal with you later. I got a more pressing problem," and starts to try to erect a new barrier, but it's not strong enough. So what does our good hero do, Andrew?
He not even the Seven Rings of Ragador can stop the Mindless Ones alone, not without the help of the amulet.
It's the amulet! The amulet bathes Dormammu in its power, and that adds to Dormammu's strength and replenishes him enough to rebuild a new barrier that holds. So this really ticks Dormammu off, because now Dormammu is indebted to Strange, cannot slay him, and Strange says, "Listen, I'll lift whatever debt you have against me on basically two terms. One, you don't hurt the girl, and two, you promise never to invade our dimension," which is really kind of significant. This oath gets honored and weaseled around in plenty of Dormammu's lawyerly mystical ways for really, actually decades to come, but the oath is always really referred to, and this is where it's made.
And it's also, again, we're coming on these awesome fantasy tropes of you bind a magical creature to his word, but it's held very literally. So like dealing with a powerful genie or whatever, any sort of misconstrued wording or whatever, and you're the one that's going to pay the price, or any deal you make in the Devil and Daniel Webster, any of these classic stories where it's a person against a much more powerful force trying to bind it with words. And we're going to see Dormammu push the interpretation every possible way you can.
Absolutely. And that wraps things up. When Strange returns from this adventure, he's rewarded by the Ancient One. He's given a couple of new wondrous gifts. A new cape, which here is depicted in all yellow, but it would be the red and yellow cloak of levitation that we'd come to know and love for decades until Strange would lose it, like last year or whatever. And he's given a new wondrous amulet, which again is unnamed here, but it also has that little eye in the middle, and it's very obviously what we come to know and love as the Eye of Agamotto.
And here's the rounded amulet you would reference before we had the square one. And I was thinking, it's great to get these, but I'm wondering if Doctor Strange wasn't like, I could have used these about 5 hours ago.
Right, exactly.
When I was overpowered by a, ruler of another dimension. But, better late than never, I guess. But it plays into the classic sort of the hero has to earn the better weapon through his trial and experience, so I don't really have a problem with it, but it's kind of funny. It's like, yeah, this would have been handy, like when I was losing really badly to Dormammu back then.
And this gives us kind of a good jumping off point, though, in a place, kind of a natural break where the character became a more sort of established, again with now another arch villain. Like you said, his tropes, his powers, his look, and everything else is established for his adventures to go forward from here. And they're not just reaching around trying to see what's going to work, and things get even more wild. So we will have to do a part two of this, whether it's for next time or a time after that or whenever. It would be fun to read through the rest of this stuff because I'm pretty giddy on it right now.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing is that this new red cape look really lasts a pretty long time, which is something for the modern world of superheroes where costumes change seemingly every other month or whatever. It's nice that he gets this look.
You bet.
Not a dramatic difference, but it's a difference, and that's the look he's held for years and years.
It's the classic look for sure. All right, Andrew, let's wrap this up. Thanks for coming out again and doing this with me. Let's do it again sometime soon.
Thanks a lot for inviting me, and I'm always ready.
All right, until next time, may the hosts of the Vishanti smile upon you, and may the dread Dormammu never speak your name. Later.